the place to come for Connecticut talk. It's the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. Join the conversation, 203-333-9422. Now, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show. Kicking things off this week with really the news story that everybody's been talking about. If you've turned on the TV or went on Facebook or Twitter or whatever at any point during this week, you've heard this story. It is the stepmom who is accused by authorities of holding her stepson captive in their home for 20 years in Waterbury. Joining us on the line now to discuss this is a gentleman who represents part of Waterbury in the state legislature. You've heard him on the show here before. It's Republican State Representative Joe Paletta. Joe, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show.
Morning, Mike.
So, Joe, tell us, just walk us through this. This story broke, of course, and it was immediately became sort of the big thing everyone was talking about. How did you learn about this case, and what was sort of the scuttlebutt about Waterbury? It's a very tight-knit community, I know, and sometimes the folks on the ground hear more than the folks maybe just watching the news here.
Mike, you're absolutely right. Actually, the nickname of Waterbury is the center of the universe because everyone seems to know everybody, and for some reason, this fell through the cracks. You know, I learned about it first, obviously, through, like many other people, through the media. When I read the story, when I first heard about the stepmother being arrested last week due to this terrible, terrible living condition and the way she treated her stepson, starving him, this just inhumane way of raising a child for 20 years. And I think it just shed some light that you know, there could be some cracks within DCF, and we may need to have a hearing and find out what went wrong, go on a fact-finding mission, and perhaps make some changes to current law.
We'll talk about that in a sec, Joe, but first I want to ask you, so in the Waterbury community, was there any indication, you know, I heard on Chaz and AJ on our sister station, WPLR here, I heard a neighbor saying basically they didn't really see anything out of the ordinary. Obviously, anytime something like this happens, you have that sort of cliched interview on the street where the person goes, well, I had no idea. He seemed like a regular guy, a regular gal. Was there any indication that there was something going on here? Did people in the community maybe know of one thing or another when it came to this family and the allegations that are now being leveled?
It's a great question, and I will certainly be listening because it's hard for me, not as a politician, but as a human being, to believe that for 20 years, for someone who has family and friends in the greater Waterbury area, that nobody knew what was going on. I mean, there's been rumors, and these are just rumors, that there was a husband that passed away within the last year or two that was living also in the home, and there might have been other people living in the home. So there is certainly more to this story, but I think what's shocking is that someone could do this to somebody for so long and get away with it, and no one say anything. I don't know a single person in my life that has gone 20 years without talking to another person. To hide a child and harbor a child for 20 years and starve them, lock them in a room, it's unfathomable.
We're chatting with State Representative Joe Paletta. He represents a portion of Waterbury in the legislature. Joe, let's get to the public policy side of this. Obviously, there's the community angle. There's the sort of criminal justice angle that's going to play itself out in the court system now. But there's also a lot of questions about the government, the state government's responsibility here. Typically, and I'll just say this as a generalization, typically if something horrible happens to a person for years on end, that person's suffering is not the fault necessarily of just one person. There's a lot of people, whether it's accomplices at fault. And it begs the question when you hear something as grotesque as this, these allegations, it begs the question of at what point is the state government or even the local government perhaps responsible for understanding that this is happening? So what do you know about the state government's knowledge of this situation? And then we'll talk about maybe what needs to be changed to prevent, obviously, something like this from happening again.
Yes, great question. So first of all, I don't believe the local police or local authorities did anything wrong here. I think, you know, just preliminarily, what we're learning is that there was a complaint complaint filed with the state DCF. The then principal, last name was Pannone, principal of a school that has since shuttered in 2005. We're talking 20 years ago. He filed a complaint with the state. Okay, this is all, again, it's kind of breaking news, truthfully, and perhaps some of your listeners will, you know, understand that, that there's the details are coming out in real time. But the complaint was filed. It was looked into locally, which I think the local police followed the protocol of what I'm being told. But what happened was the complaint was then found to be, you know, they basically expunged it, and they don't even have a record of it anymore. And that is where the policy change, I think, needs to come into play. Why was there a complaint filed? The individual was pulled out of school 20 years ago, and then there was never a follow-up? Something went wrong here, and there needs to be some answers. And I do realize that due to the time span, that maybe some of the people working at DCF right now were not even employed at the time. But we need to look at policy, because this can never happen again.
State Representative Joe Paletta on the line with us, Joe. So what does accountability look like? Again, obviously we're going to see the court system play out with this mother and the allegations against her, and potentially allegations against others who may have involved in the treatment of this gentleman. Is there accountability at the state level? You mentioned something interesting, and you and I were part of a couple private conversations in the last couple days with other legislators talking about, well, what does accountability look like? And you brought up a really good point, which is many of the people who would have been or could have been responsible for stopping a thing like this or noticing a thing like this, some of them may not be in state service anymore. Some of them may not be alive anymore. Right? We're talking about events that took place 20 years ago. So what does accountability look like, not just for the people who may have been directly involved in the neglect here? Of course, we want that system to shake itself out. But at a broader level, there must be some accountability for the officials who may or may not have dropped the ball.
Yes, Mike. Again, another great point. So just, let's just take it back to 2005 for one quick second. So a complaint is filed. Principal notices that this young gentleman is, you know, looks like he's malnourished, reports that he was eating out of garbage cans, picking food. And so an administrator does the right thing, brings it to the attention of DCF, Department of Children and Families. DCF looks at it. My understanding is they did do a house visit, because the individual, by his stepmother and father at the time, was pulled out of school. So they did a visit, didn't find anything wrong. And I think here's where the problem comes in. There was no follow-up. It was the visit, and that was it. And then there was no future visits. There was no checking up. There was no, hey, is this individual still malnourished? Does he need help? There was no forms, even a form that could have been sent to the home once a year saying, you're homeschooling your child. Is everything okay? Are you attesting that this minor is okay and is not, you know, being mistreated? I mean, I hate to use the word starvation, but starvation and just making sure that he's getting the proper education and care for like a child should, all children should. So that's where I think we need some change here. If there's a complaint filed, and an individual is removed from school or from their normal course of action, then the question's got to be why. And then if there's, again, goes back to the complaint, what was in that complaint? It was pretty specific. And there was no follow-up after that first initial visit. That's where I think the ball was dropped here.
We've got State Representative Joe Paletta on the line. He's a state representative, a Waterbury guy. His district includes portions of Waterbury and a lot of Watertown, Connecticut. Joe, I've got a question on a lot. I think there's a lot of folks who have a lot of questions on this. One of them, I thought, as a political reporter, is what you just mentioned, the issue of homeschool. And it's interesting. We've seen since the pandemic this surge in interest in homeschool, and people can have all kind of views on it. I'm not making a comment on the efficacy or the virtues or lack of virtue of homeschooling. What I will say is there are states in this country that have really embraced homeschooling. And not knowing much about this, I would assume when you, as a state, make a decision, hey, we're going to embrace homeschooling, maybe the next thing you'd want to do is set up what you just talked about, monitoring not just the welfare standards and the living standards, but also the academic standards, right? And Connecticut, as a blue state, really hasn't, you haven't seen an outward embrace of homeschooling, so we might not have the kind of emphasis on let's make sure the academics are up to par, let's make sure the conditions are up to par. Is there an angle there in this situation of, hey, there's an increased interest in homeschooling. There are, I would assume, Connecticut, maybe not as much as other states, but in some ways along that trend line of more homeschooling, more sort of out-of-the-classroom schooling. Do you see any policy changes there? Maybe the state, whether it's DCF, whether it's the State Department of Education, needs to kind of get on the ball there because there's more kids now outside the umbrella of the public school system. The public school system's, of course, imperfect. Abuse happens there, too. But this sort of new reality where there's a lot more people being homeschooled, what do you think the state needs to do to kind of make sure that system is, that there's accountability there?
Yeah. So, one, you know, I'm not familiar. I don't sit on the education committee, so I'm not familiar if there are yearly or, you know, at the end of each school year, checkups on, you know, how good academically a child is doing that is homeschooled. I think that's a debate, maybe perhaps a good idea for a public hearing or a study group to figure out, you know, what we can do to make sure that the children that are home are still getting the same quality education as those that are in school. So I think that's a great idea. But what I think we really need to focus in on is when that complaint is made and brought to a state official or local official's attention. So, you know, for the vast majority of kids that are homeschooled, I'm sure their parents are good-hearted people and they want what's best for their children. And I love that about these parents and children that, you know, maybe just they're homeschooled for whatever choice. It's a choice. But when something is brought to the attention of the DCF or the local authorities, and we have a moral obligation to continually check up on those children, at least until they're legal adults. And that's what did not happen here. So, you know, you want to homeschool your child, that's fine. But once someone brings something to the attention that says, hey, you know, perhaps this child isn't learning what they're supposed to be learning, or perhaps this child isn't getting the nutrients, or they're not, you know, getting the social whatever component of life, then, or they're not coming out much, or there's something going on there. Maybe it should be looked into. They shouldn't just say, okay, we're going to do one visit and then discard it and expunge it. That's where there was an issue here. And I know it's a fine line between personal privacy, but when something's brought, you know, to someone's attention, I think they have a moral obligation to continually look after those individuals, especially our most vulnerable, which are our children.
State Representative Joe Paletta, I think that's a good note to leave it on. Thank you for joining us and offering your insights, both as a legislator and as a guy who's lived in and around the Waterbury area and represents part of Waterbury in the legislature. What can we expect next from you and from the legislature? Are there going to be inquiries, do you think? Is it kind of too early to say?
Yeah, I'm, you know, certainly going to advocate for a public hearing on this where we can bring in all the stakeholders and the Committee on Children's or whoever Committee of Cognizance can ask some questions. But, you know, I'll just say this, you know, as someone who I'm not a parent yet, maybe one day if we're fortunate, but I just will say that, you know, morally and just deep inside, it's heartbreaking what happened. And the individual had to literally start a fire with hand sanitizer to get the attention of the outside world. It's horrific, and I feel for him. And I'm just so glad that there's been a GoFundMe set up and that they've raised money for this individual. And I'm hopeful that he can turn the corner and survive here and lead a somewhat normal life. But I never want to see this happen again in the state of Connecticut or anywhere for that matter.
State Representative Joe Paletta, thank you for joining us, Joe. We'll obviously stay on top of this story for the next foreseeable future, as long as it takes to kind of get some answers here. So thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. And safe travels this weekend. And tell Billy and the guys I said hi, all right?
Thanks, Michael.
See ya. That was State Representative Joe Paletta, one of the state representatives who represents Waterbury, Connecticut in the legislature. Joe is a Republican. And you've heard him here on the show before, but I think an interesting voice to have on as people sort of sort through pretty horrifying allegations. And they are allegations. Obviously, want to point that out, that in this country we have a presumption of innocence, and anytime we cover crime, we want to emphasize that. But my goodness, that police report, 5'9", I believe, 68 pounds, rotted teeth, just a horrifying situation. So we're going to go take a bottom of the hour break for a few minutes here, get you some news around the state and around the country. I'm sure you'll hear an update on the story out of Waterbury. And when we come back, we're going to shift gears a little bit, talk about Another element of Connecticut that I think is undercovered, but I think everybody interacts with in one way or another, that's coming up next. For now, some news for you, some updates, and we'll be right back here on the Mike Cerulli Show.
Live and local news and talk for New Canaan. It's the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. Join the conversation, 203-333-9422.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show. Thanks to our pal Joe Paletta for joining us in the last a few minutes to give us a breakdown of one of the top stories in our state. Joining us now, we're kind of going a different direction, but I find this topic endlessly fascinating, which is the state of the legal cannabis industry here in Connecticut. And a big part of legalization in the United States has been this reckoning with, hey, there are a lot of young men, predominantly black and Hispanic young men, who were put in prison by this country for possessing, dealing a substance that's now broadly legal, that a lot of people are making money off of. And so as states around the country have legalized cannabis, they've reckoned with this question of, it can't be fair that people who just have the ability to invest in this market right now are going to make money off of it, while you have a whole generation, if not multiple generations, in multiple communities who have suffered from the legalization and criminalization, and I would say selective criminalization, of possession and sale of cannabis. And so one thing Connecticut's done is they've set up sort of a number of entities, but one central entity that I think their primary responsibility is to sort of reckon with this question, and in a very substantive way, directly try and get some of that cold hard cash and resources from the legal industry into the communities that have most suffered from, again, what I would consider the selective criminalization of something that is now broadly legal, celebrated, and profitable. And joining us now is the person who's been put in charge by Governor Ned Lamont of reckoning with this, you know, question that arguably gets at the core of the United States of America, of fairness and reckoning with our history. It's no small task, but this guy's definitely someone who's up for it, I think. It's Brandon McGee, former state representative, former political director for Governor Ned Lamont, and now executive director of what the state calls the Social Equity Council. Brandon, welcome to the Mike Cerulli Show.
Cerulli, thank you. Glad to be here. Happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday to you, too. So did I get the description right? Because I do think, you know, sometimes people might hear, especially in today's day and age, they're going to hear Social Equity Council, and they might go, what does that do? Did I kind of get the description right of what your charge is in terms of your job with the state?
Yes, absolutely. And I really appreciate you providing a bit of context for your listeners. Before I actually jump in and explain quickly the Social Equity Council, I think it's important to know that I work alongside the State Department of Consumer Protection, who serve as our chief regulators in this space. So there are some things that are not in my wheelhouse, right? And so we leave that up to DCP. That said, the Social Equity Council was established somewhere around 2021. And a really quick story, I had the opportunity while serving in the legislature help shape what is now legal adult use cannabis in the state of Connecticut. But one of the things that my colleagues and I, members of the Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus, we said to ourselves, look, it's cool that we're responding to this in a very thoughtful way, but how do we sustain and reimagine these communities most impacted by the war on drugs? Thus, you have the Social Equity Council. And our mission is really simple. We were statutorily created to advance equitable economic prosperity. We essentially support Connecticut's cannabis social equity entrepreneurs through financial assistance and investment strategies, while also, and I think this is chief among them, we reinvest the state's cannabis revenue into communities disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. So we're working alongside municipalities. We're working alongside individuals, as you've already articulated, you know, went to jail for drug convictions, et cetera. Now they're returning home only to have that big scarlet letter still on their chest and unable to live successful lives, right? And so we're here to identify and address those barriers, not only for the individual, but in the business startup process, simplifying access to capital, removing obstacles for applicants, and also I think, which is important to a lot of people, is expanding job training and employment opportunities. So, and lastly, yep, Cerulli, let me just say this. We're currently funded by social equity license and what we refer to as conversion fees. And 60% of that, of the cannabis sales tax, our council, we reinvest, the reinvestment capacity essentially will expand over the next couple years with allocations increasing to about 65% in 2027, and then 75% by 2029, creating more opportunities. But I just figured that would be important to your listeners as well.
So we've got Brandon McGee on the line. He's the executive director of the state Social Equity Council. Brandon, there might be listeners who don't know the process of getting the, you know, of being approved by the state to sell cannabis legally. What is a social equity entrepreneur? Because that might sound to some people like sort of a buzzword, but it actually means something very substantive, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And, you know, in an environment where buzzwords like DEI or equity are being attacked, you know, I stand too flat-footed, right, against the notion that these are bad words. Equity is extremely important to the state of Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont, and all of the 17 council members that make up the board of directors that oversee the Social Equity Council. Now, let's just say, Mike Cerulli, you are interested in becoming a social equity entrepreneur. The first thing you would have to do, we would encourage you all to visit the Department of Consumer Protection's website, right, to better ascertain, am I ready for this, right? Maybe I can afford the license fee. Doesn't matter the license type, but I can afford the $1,500 to start a business. A few eligibility requirements. You must have been a resident of an approved disproportionately impacted area, i.e. maybe New Haven, Hartford. There are other places throughout the state, but those just come to mind. You would have had to live in that particular DIA and be able to prove that you were a resident there. The other piece is income eligibility, right? Because we're talking about individuals who are now looking to not only gain financial security, but generational wealth. And we want to ensure that we're intentional about creating opportunities for said individuals. And so we have a pretty intense eligibility verification application background. We then, let's just say you are approved in that process. The Social Equity Council then works alongside, during this preliminary phase or provisional status, we work alongside the social equity applicant to develop a social equity plan to help articulate how do you, and this applies to all businesses, by the way, how do you plan to reinvest your funds and work alongside those communities that we are seeking to help reimagine and revitalize? And then there's also a workforce development plan. All goes well, everything is approved, you are then ready to stand up your business. So it sounds easy as I'm saying it, but it is a very, very nuanced process.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Brandon McGee you're listening to. He's the executive director of the State Social Equity Council. Brandon, I want to just take a step back from this. There might be people listening to this who are like you, and I think honestly like me, where I say, look, I understand, you know, I am on board with the notion that there are these communities, and I'll just take where I grew up. I grew up in Trumbull, Connecticut, right? Let's take go in the time machine back to the 80s and the 90s, and even before and after that. But let's just take the kind of peak of the war on drugs. If you were a kid in Trumbull, maybe 18, 19 years old, and you were selling, you know, a few ounces of marijuana to your friends in the parking lot of Trumbull High School, the chances you got, not to say that there weren't people that got arrested and sent to jail for it in Trumbull, but the chances you got arrested for it were certainly much lower than if you were a student at Harding High School or Central High School just 10 minutes down the road in Bridgeport. And the notion of the Social Equity Council says basically, because of that and because of the historical application of our laws in different ways, depending on geography, community, and ultimately race, I think, that there should be some corrective action taken by the government. There may be some people who are not on board with that, Brandon McGee. They may say, wait a minute, why is the government saying you can only, you know, to get this type of license, you have to live in this area for a certain number of of years or something like that. So just defend for me the notion of, hey, there's a type of license to do a business in Connecticut that you have to live somewhere in order to get. Talk to me about someone who says, I think that's fundamentally unfair. Maybe they're more of a free market capitalist, more of a maybe libertarian, and they say, why does this requirement exist? Why can't it just be like, you know, kind of any other business where if you've got the capital, if you've got the know-how, you can open up the storefront?
Sure. Very loaded question, only a Mike Cerulli question, so I appreciate it. You know, just to break this apart a little bit, any and everybody have the opportunity to purchase a license, whether it's a cultivation or a dispensary, et cetera. You know, you don't have to hail from a DIA, right? Mm-hmm. But we've carved out in legislation opportunities for individuals. And by the way, they're not all Black and Hispanic. There are white folk.
Fair.
There are Asians. There are others, right, who qualify or identify.
Yeah. A lot of Asian people in the pop business, Brandon McGee.
Yeah, right. and so any and everybody have an opportunity at this particular business venture. But specifically regarding social equity applicants, it is very intentional that we are driving the business opportunity for individuals who are from, for example, I am from the north end of Hartford, and I would qualify, right, for the opportunity to benefit from the social equity applicant sort of status. That means I have access to, you know, 50% of what it may cost to purchase a license because of my income eligibility, because of where I hail from and all of the barriers. Oh, and chief among them, the war on drugs that basically impacted the lives of so many people in these particular communities throughout the state of Connecticut. So we don't want to lose sight of that. Places like Trumbull, I'm not sure, and I will stand corrected, weren't targeted communities with respect to arrests, right?
Totally. Ask anybody who grew up there and say, hey, do you remember anybody in your community? Again, not to say it didn't happen, not to say there wasn't anyone treated unfairly in the town of Trumbull, but come on.
That's right.
You know, it's like, go just ask someone who grew up there, right?
I'd like to also lift up, we're talking about poverty. We're talking about underemployment, which really has to do with individuals who are formerly incarcerated or unemployed, individuals who are ready for the workforce, but just they can't find it in these particular communities. And so the idea is really to utilize the framework by which we're working in to reinvest opportunity, or rather resources, in communities that may lack infrastructure, lack access to housing, lack access to, you know, walking to a grocery store, right? And so all of this is a part of a larger conversation as to how do we reimagine communities throughout the state of Connecticut, particularly those communities who experience the war on drugs. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about that. We're still trying to, you know, figure out how do we destigmatize adult use cannabis in a world where we, you know, we have oversaturated and tried to normalize cannabis, right? And so it's interesting. I had a conversation with my nephew who is of age, about 25. He's like, Uncle B, you know, you're working in this space now. Like, how are you able to talk to, you know, your faith community and, you know, young people who are in high school whose parents are like, why is Brandon McGee, former state rep, why is he doing that, right? And I stepped back and I looked at my nephew and I said, you know why? Because the reality is we've got to, similar to this idea of alcohol, we've got to talk about what many of our young people are already experiencing and have experienced. And it is, I believe, the social equity's responsibility to work alongside community stakeholders who serve as trusted messengers to help, you know, center around the importance of being responsible and good citizens, right? And so my goal is not to go out and be like, y'all buy more cannabis. My key focus area is community reinvestment, developing clear investment strategies to maximize impact, and also support entrepreneurs, improving resources, funding, application processes, et cetera. And so it's a very nuanced task that I've been given, of which I am extremely passionate about. But there are some harsh realities that we're going to have to grapple with in the very communities who says drugs is the very reason why, you know, we believe our community is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I can argue against that, you know, but the same token is, hey, folks, it's here.
Right.
It's here. And by the way, this may be another conversation. It's not a gateway. And I know I'm going to ruffle some feathers. But yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, every one of these sentences we were uttering here could be an hour long or 2 or 3 hour long conversation about history and all of that. But I want to ask you, Brandon McGee, Social Equity Council, you mentioned at the top, I do want to delineate between what you do and what our friend Brian Caffarelli does, where he's got guys with badges and guns who kick doors in if people are breaking some of the state's laws. You, Brandon McGee, are on the reinvestment side. So I want to ask, again, huge question here, but how is that going, right? What are the revenues looking like? You know, there's this constant conversation about, is the state getting a return on its investment, you know, legalization? We're promised all this revenue. Yep. Is the revenue there? And then what happens to that money after? I know that's a huge question. We only have like 7 minutes here, but tell me, how's it going? How's the reinvestment going?
Absolutely, and I'll be extremely clear, concise here. I took over less than 8 months ago. We've already undergone a strategic planning process that really helped to clarify a lot of our key program areas so that we're better able to administer programs. So that said, Connecticut, we're the youngest with respect to the adult cannabis industry compared to our sister states, New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, et cetera, right? So you can't compare us to their industry at the moment. We're only about 2.5, 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, give or take, we've probably, I'll say the last time I looked, we're somewhere around $16.5 million in revenue around cannabis taxes. That's a lot of money, and that's extremely, we're trending, we're upticking, we're doing extremely well, but we also have a lot of challenges, okay? That is, our potency rate is nowhere near mass, so folks are still going over the line, they're doing what they have to do. Our marketing, you know, is not where I believe it should be, but for various reasons, and that's another conversation. But what we've been able to do is, the Social Equity Council, we're funded by the taxes, again, as I've said at the outset. And so our personnel, our operations, all of our programs come out of this fund, this account. And essentially, in short order, we're going to be reinvesting these dollars back into targeted DIAs throughout the state, again, to reimagine these communities. Now, you've all read in the news, I'm sure, there was a turbulent time with the SEC, right? There was about a $6 million investment through our community reinvestment program, of which, you know, it did not yield the anticipated success I believe the council really desired. And so here we are. We were able to level set, convene our people, have some more strategic conversations, better understand the data, and by the end of this fiscal year, we'll be able to release a notice of funding opportunity for those CBOs to apply for some of these reinvestment dollars.
Let me just ask you about that, Brandon. You mentioned you've been on the job for about 8 months. You came in under what I would call a cloud of question or skepticism about the way some of that money was being spent, the recipients of it, how those recipients were being decided. There were sort of suggestions maybe of some favoritism or less than on the level distribution of that funds. Our friend Sean Scanlon did an investigation into the distribution of social equity funds and found some problems. And that's one of the reasons you're in this job. What can you say to the taxpayer, to the person who is participating in Connecticut's legal cannabis market? What can you say Brandon McGee is doing to make sure that trust is there when it comes to the distribution of these funds?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that question. And at the request of Governor Lamont, Sean Scanlon's office did an extremely well job, you know, helping us to identify those pain points. But I will say, as I've said already, the strategic plan really created what I am experiencing at the moment, an improved access to funding, training, and job growth initiatives, right, to tangibly impact the Social Equity Council's mission and vision. And I know, and those around the table within my organization know, that success will be measured through trackable metrics, of which we did not have, stakeholder feedback, of which we had, but we never synthesized, and transparent reporting. And when you are clear on where investments are being made and that there are clear return on those investments, whether it is through community grants or our revolving loan program, right? We're making sure we have thought partners in the space to help us be smart in areas where we are not. And so I will say, you know, we have an approved strategic plan of which we're implementing. Taxpayers, I want them to be reassured that these dollars are being spent wisely, and we're thinking critically when we distribute funds. And our doors are always open, you know, for critical feedback, right, and helping us to remain honest and true to the mission and vision of the Social Equity Council.
Brandon McGee, Executive Director of the Social Equity Council, thanks so much for joining us for a bit here on the Mike Cerulli Show. I know people are fascinated by this topic, and I will say, on a leaving note, and I know this, again, maybe gets more into Commissioner Caffarelli's arena. I was in Vermont recently, and I don't really, you know me, Brandon, I'm not really I don't really partake in our state's legal cannabis market. And I was up in Vermont recently, and I told a few friends of mine, and they all said, hey, could you pick me up some stuff from the dispensaries up there? And I didn't. But I was like, wait, again, naive me who doesn't really partake in this. I was like, why would I do? Brandon McGee's working on this here in Connecticut. Why wouldn't you use the Connecticut legal market? And I was informed by friends of mine who said, hey, the potency, they use different words for it, but what you just said, the potency, what's the deal with that? Are we gonna up the numbers here in Connecticut? What are we talking about? Is that more Caffarelli's arena, or
that's more Caffarelli and the company there? But we have met with many of our entrepreneurs, and that is one of their major pain points. You know, how are we to be competitive in this industry, and we can't get the basics right? And so this is a longer and deeper conversation with legislators, municipalities, to just level set, right? And through conversation, I think we're able to tackle those challenges.
Got it. Brandon McGee, thank you so much. We'd love to have you back on the show. And by the way, you can catch Brandon on Capitol Report on News 8 WTNH tomorrow at 10:30. He's a regular panelist on the show offering his insights, because in addition to being the executive director of the Social Equity Council, Brandon, you've had quite the career in Connecticut politics, which I'm sure is far from over. And I want to thank you for joining us this morning. And we'll have you back
thank
on
you,
soon.
Thank you, Cerulli.
All right, see
you. Take care, bud. Bye.
That's Brandon McGee, Executive Director of the Social Equity Council. Really interesting role. I wanted to have him on for a lot of reasons, but one is because we always talk about cannabis in the context of, you know, road safety and stuff on this show. And, of course, that's a serious issue. But wanted to show the other side of this, that this is an emerging industry here in Connecticut. A lot of entrepreneurs getting engaged and some very interesting policies being implemented. And Brandon McGee's the guy's doing it. So we're going to have in the next couple hours, some discussions about that issue everyone's been calling in about, everyone talks to me about, which is energy prices. We're going to have one Republican, one Democrat on, talk about some solutions. And the President of the United States has weighed in on all this. We'll tell what he's saying coming up here. Stay with us. You're listening to the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC.
Nonstop live Connecticut talk. You're listening to the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC, 203-333-9422. Call now and join the conversation.
So for the last year or so, people have been very upset with the relatively high cost of energy here in the state of Connecticut. And the question I get, the question I'm sure legislators get all the time is, you know, what are those guys up in Hartford going to do about it? And we're entering the portion of the legislative session where bills are actually starting to move from the sort of committee process where they're analyzed and people can testify on them to the point where they might actually have a chance of being passed and signed into law. And joining us now on the line is a guest we've had on the show before here. It's State Representative Matt Blumenthal. And State Representative Blumenthal, first of all, welcome back to the show. And second of all, you have a bill that is moving right now through the legislature that you say could help address energy costs. How so? Tell us about it. And I know it's on a topic people might not necessarily associate with energy, but could potentially impact the bills that people get in their mailbox.
Well, thanks, Mike, for having me and for allowing us to have this discussion. Always good to be with you. Yeah, so in the Government Administration and Elections Committee, of which I am House Chairman, we have two bills that will be working to try to address energy costs. And before I tell you what's in them, I probably should tell you a little bit about how energy works and how the numbers are calculated that get into your bill.
Yeah.
There are several components of an individual's energy bill, electricity bill. One is supply, and that's the one we all think about. When we think, what's the cost of electricity? We're thinking, you know, what are we paying the power plant to make it? And that cost is set by the market. We can't control it. It has gone up. But ultimately, it's subject to global market pressures and availability. And we have to do more to get more electricity supply into Connecticut. But that is a 10 or 20 year battle. The other two usually main elements of your bill are transmission and distribution. And that's essentially what the power company that you pay, the utility, Eversource or UI, or if you're in a smaller town, your municipal utility. That's how much they are getting paid to carry the electricity from the power plant to your door. And that is where they make their profit.
Right.
That is the portion of the bill that is regulated by the federal and state government. And that's usually where the shocking amount that people are paying is. And, you know, keep in mind, these are massive monopolies. The utilities were paying to do this work. They have Connecticut consumers and consumers in other states at their mercy, but for the regulation that we put forward. And one of the primary ways that they make money, especially in the distribution portion of that bill, is by building projects for which they are reimbursed at a guaranteed 10% almost profit. As you can imagine, that creates powerful incentives to build yeah, expensively, to build without, you know, sustainability and permanence in mind. And that's why this little known agency known as the Siting Council is so essential to your energy bill, because it's the agency that reviews those projects and makes sure that they are appropriate for the state.
Right. We've all heard about PURA. We've all heard, well, those of us that pay attention to this, we've all heard about PURA. We've all heard about, in many cases, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. State Representative Blumenthal, this Siting Council you're saying could be key to all this here because they have a regulatory role over the utility companies.
Yeah, and it's one of the main ways that we regulate how electricity can be paid for, because it's a significant place where the utilities make their money. These are projects that cost the ratepayers, meaning all of your listeners, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. They can seize property through eminent domain, private property, and kick people off their land. They can seize public property or throwaways that a city or town has planned to develop in the future for economic development purposes. So it's really essential that this body called the Siting Council has all the skills, sophistication, resources, and competence to vet these projects and make sure that every dollar of them is justified. And I think what, if you ask a lot of people in this space, whether that's what's happening right now, they would say no. So basically what our bill does is it gives the Siting Council additional informational requirements, and it gives one particular party in the Siting Council, known as the Consumer Council, increased powers and authorities. That Consumer Council is essentially a small law office that's set up to defend the public's interest in the Siting Council to make sure that the consumers are represented and frankly aren't getting ripped off. So this office is one that does not have automatic participation in these proceedings. And so this bill would give them automatic participation if they wanted it. It would give them increased resources because they're very overmatched by the experts and lawyers on the other side in these proceedings, the lawyers and experts hired by the utilities. And it increases disclosure requirements to the utilities about their projects, how they're making money from them, and it requires them to include grid-enhancing technologies to provide for our energy future and the consideration of those technologies. So it's basically, you know, it's a bill to increase the strength of the oversight of these projects. Again, these massive projects that blast through our towns, which sometimes, I'm sure, are very necessary, but there are powerful incentives for them not to be in the best interest or the least expensive form of the public. So it's vital that this agency has all the tools and resources and, frankly, the expertise to fly spec all these applications to make sure the utilities aren't trying to take more money from Connecticut residents than they absolutely need to cover their costs.
Tell me about, we're chatting with State Representative Matt Blumenthal. Tell me about the Office of Consumer Counsel. I mean, we chat about this issue all the time. I cover it a lot in sort of all the roles I have covering Connecticut news. And a lot of people are not aware of the fact that they do have this individual, Claire Coleman, who's kind of the cop on the beat, right? You know, people always ask, like, kind of who's on their side. And look, you know, depending on if they're lean red or lean blue, they might look at someone like you, or they might look at someone like Ryan Fazio or whomever and say, ah, that the Norm Needleman's on my side or Ryan Fazio's on my side. But there is a person who statutorily is supposed to do all of this. And tell us how that function works and how you might be able to proverbially give the cop on the beat some more teeth.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. The Consumer Counsel is like the cop on the beat. And it's the person who is supposed to have the role of defending you and me, the ratepayers, making sure that we're not paying more than we need to, again, to these massive monopolies that are, you know, multi-billion dollar companies on projects that are tremendously expensive and can have real negative effects if they're not well planned. And so she is a lawyer who runs essentially a small office of experts and lawyers that are supposed to be fighting back on behalf of the consumers. The Siting Council and PURA are kind of quasi-judicial authorities, boards. And this person, the Consumer Council, is the lawyer for the people in those proceedings.
Right.
And so it's, you know, it's an office that is overwhelmingly overmatched by the lawyers and experts and scientists that the utilities are able to hire to try to justify their project. And by the way, they were reimbursed for all of those experts and lawyers until just a couple years ago when we passed legislation to ban that.
Well, hang on a minute, Matt Blumenthal. So Eversource and United Illuminating, these companies that post hundreds of millions of dollars in profits, they pay, and look, I don't know what Claire Coleman makes. I'm assuming it's not more than $200,000 or $400,000. I would say if I had to bet, she probably is making in the $150,000 to $200,000 range. That's probably the starting salary of a junior attorney on these cases at Eversource. You're telling me that when Eversource spends all that money and hires all those lawyers, as they have a right to do, right, as a party to these proceedings, but when they hire all these lawyers, up until a few years ago, up until you all in the legislature changed this, they could actually get reimbursed by the state or some state entity for all those costs?
It is wild. Not only would they be reimbursed by some state entity, they were reimbursed by the ratepayers. So the costs that they were paying to lobby us or PURA or the Siting Council to get more money and increase your bills, those costs were paid for by the ratepayer. We ended that. And frankly, it should have been ended a long time ago.
Yeah. Again, they have a right to lobby. They have a right to have legal counsel. But I don't think there's any other entities that expect the people of the state of Connecticut to foot the bill for them. So Claire Coleman, if your legislation, Matt, goes into effect, then this advocate for the consumer will have the ability to argue before the Siting Council, which is this entity that is a venue for some of the items that go on to ratepayer bills. That's kind of the long and short of this.
Yeah, so she'll have an automatic right to intervene in a case. That would require her to probably have a few more staff, but we think that she should get She needs the resources and authorities to fight back on behalf of the ratepayer. And again, if these projects are signed off and they go forward and they're expensed, then the ratepayers have to pay for them at an almost 10% guaranteed profit. Mm-hmm. And when they come before PURA, you know, these are costs that legally the utilities are guaranteed to get paid back. It's not like PURA can say, oh no, you know, we didn't think you did a good job on this project. It's the siting council's job to sign off on them. So once these costs are signed off on, they go to the ratepayers. And so, you know, this is a situation where you need to cut things off at the pass early if they're not well-justified projects mm-hmm. that could be very expensive. And it's a place of government that's kind of quiet and people aren't always looking at. So it's vitally important to get the Consumer Council more resources and access. It's vital to get more information from the utilities about these projects, how they're making money on them and how they're lobbying them. And it's vital that these projects be serving the future of Connecticut. And so that's what this bill helps do.
Got it. State Representative Matt Blumenthal, it's all the time I've got right now, but I want to follow this piece of legislation. I want to talk more about it because I think it's complicated, but as we've talked about, you and I, it is really important. And there is a fundamental imbalance between the utilities and the ratepayers when it comes to these proceedings that affect ratepayer bills. So we're going to keep an eye on this bill, and we want to have you back on the show, and I want to talk to you more about it for in the future. So thanks for joining us, and we'll by the way, before I let you go, and I have only a minute here, is this bipartisan support for this? Are there Republicans who they've been making a lot of noise about electricity bills? Is there Republican support behind this bill?
I'm hopeful that there will be. We passed bipartisan legislation on the Siting Council last year that was a down payment on increasing accountability and transparency and oversight. I was proud to co-author that bill. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that we'll get bipartisan support on this. And when you say it's complicated, that's an understatement. Utility policy is tremendously complex, and everybody's eyes, frankly, glaze over when they start paying attention to it for more than a minute or two. But that's what the utilities are counting on. They're counting on us to throw up our hands, but there's real things we can do to increase oversight and to lower our bills, and we're working on them here in the legislature.
Got it. State Representative Matt Blumenthal, we're going to stay on top of this one. Thanks for joining us here on the Mike Cerulli Show. Got some bottom-of-the-hour news coming up for you, and then we're going to talk to one of my colleagues from News 8 about some interesting technology being deployed. I'm sure you've maybe seen those videos of high-speed car chases. Well, police are going to have a new or fielding a new tool to put an end to those. That's coming up here on the Mike Cerulli Show. Stay with us.
Live and local news and talk for Trumbull. It's the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. Join the conversation, 203-333-9422.
This looks like a regular old police cruiser, right? Well, not exactly. A touch of James Bond here. It's called Star Chase, giving New Haven police officers an innovative way to track you down on a GPS mapping system if you're on the run.
That was the voice of News 8 investigative reporter Jeff Derderian talking about a very interesting technology being fielded by the New Haven Police Department. Highly recommend you go to YouTube or WTNH.com, look up New Haven Police Department DART technology. You couldn't see it, but you could hear it. It is a James Bond-style device, shoots out the front of a car. Joining us live now to describe what exactly that device is Jeff Derderian, investigative reporter. Jeff, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show.
Hey, Mike. Good Saturday morning. How's it going?
It's going well. Going well. Enjoying the morning so far. Looking forward to the parade tomorrow. Jeff, you going to be there in New Haven?
Of course. Are you kidding me?
Of course.
We're going to march together, you and I.
Yes, sir. And if anybody's looking to get into a high-speed car chase in New Haven tomorrow, first of all, don't. That'd be very dangerous. There's a parade going on. Second of all, New Haven police have this device, right? And I'll describe it. It sort of looks like it comes right out the front of the car. It shoots and it sticks onto the back of a car. Jeff, tell us what that is. What does it do? How's it keeping people safe?
Yeah, so I heard about this story, a couple of months back, and just took some logistical challenges to, you know, set it up and do it in a controlled, safe environment in a parking lot in New Haven. But New Haven police, they have this device that they can basically, if you can picture it, I know this is radio, not TV, but picture the front grille of your car. and there's like a dart that will shoot out from the grill. There's a little flap, like a door, that opens in the grill, and this dart, sticky dart, if you will, shoots out of, launches out of this piece of equipment, and it will stick basically anywhere on the back of a car. There's lasers involved that the officer inside the cruiser can adjust and basically kind of pinpoint it anywhere. He could pinpoint it on the bottom of your bumper, on the top. And what it's designed to do, Mike, is basically when cops are involved in high-speed chases, there comes a point when they have to call it off, depending on the situation. If it's a robbery, an assault, a homicide, there's all different criteria that I won't get into now, but there's all levels of chase and levels of pursuit that they can do per their protocol. So this actually gives them sort of a new tool now to be able to track people if they're trying to, you know, pull someone over, apprehend someone, because you basically launch this dart and then the cruiser, the police officer can kind of trail off and the person can keep going and they think, oh, the cop just stopped following me. So, and then they go to their house in, you know, Milford or in, you know, Southbury or whatever. And then the cops can show up at their door when they're in control of the situation. So it's really designed to keep officers and the public safe when it comes to these chases, because we've seen them, right? Especially in LA, these high speed chases, they can get out of control and they're really dangerous. So this system now allows them to, you know, basically track down and apprehend people. And they could, Mike, literally put it on in Connecticut, in New Haven. You could drive to California and, you know, as long as it doesn't come off, then they'll be able to find you. There's mapping systems, GPS systems inside the cruiser that's live, and the officer himself or herself doesn't track the person. They have a supervisor who will then sort of meet up with the officer, because what they don't want is someone driving the cruiser and then trying to map the person at the same time. So it's pretty cool technology, and we were glad to show it. And again, like you said, people can go to WTNH.com and just put in DART technology, Jeff Dedarian, and they'll be able to find it and watch it. It's pretty neat, for sure. Definitely James Bond.
Definitely James Bond. And Jeff, I know you touched on it, but I do want to dive into it because, again, I like to have conversations, you and I, because you're an investigative reporter, I'm a political reporter. I watched this story and I thought, oh, I know what this is in response to. This is in response to this heated debate in the public policy world about when police can and should chase suspect vehicles. And Connecticut is among several states, many of them Democratic-leaning states, that have said, to some degree, hey, we're going to limit police chases because police chases can be dangerous. Police chases can lead to bad car wrecks. And so compared to states like Georgia and Alabama and Arkansas and Mississippi, where, you know, if you run from the Georgia state, you know, police, you're going to get pit maneuvered off the side of the road after a while. And, you know, same would go in a lot of other southern Republican states, less so in the state of Connecticut. So tell us, is this sort of a response to the fact that in some cases police are being told, hey, you know, we're not going to be looking for high speed chases? Is that sort of the angle here, or am I kind of reading politics it doesn't belong?
You know, yeah, I don't know. You're the political guy. I'm not. So I'm going to kind of stay away from that stuff. I don't know if it's Democrat or Republican. I do know that there is a big debate among police officers about how much and how fast and how long they should chase people, because it does come down to public safety. And I think this is designed to sort of have a compromise. Now, if there's a homicide or a murder or something, you know, it depends on the level of the crime. That's going to dictate, you know, as far as I know, the level of chase and how long they're going to do it for. But that being said, you know, I have people who, you know, I'm friendly with and have done stories with on state police. And, you know, few of the folks there are a little frustrated because there are other states, Mike, that use air support specifically for high-speed chases. And so, like, Boston's one of them. So they have a chopper that will fly. And, you know, so I think they're trying to find, and I'm not putting words in New Haven police's, you know, the chief's mouth at all, but I think it, from my reporting, is that it's a happy medium in the sense that it does give the officers the ability to, you know, it gives them another tool where they don't get frustrated because somebody just gets away. So I think, you know, I think there's there's a lot of public debate and private debate within police departments about how far and, you know, how long, as I said, they should chase these folks. So it's likely a response to that. They didn't tell me that, but that's my sense just from reporting for so long that, you know, it's definitely a controversial debate in Connecticut. You're right, Mike, because in other places, Florida, Georgia, et cetera, you know, North, South Carolina, they're chasing you. So
yeah.
And they're going to use speed sticks, and they're going to use spikes, and they're going to use a ramp, you know, and, you know, there's different departments in Connecticut that are looking at other technologies really quick that, you know, basically would, from a cruiser, which it would shoot out a web that goes, that wraps around your tire.
Yeah.
And think of it like Spider-Man, and it literally will slow you down to a complete stop. So I think there's other things that, you know, departments in Connecticut are looking at to try and avoid these public chases. Because think about it. If you're on Elm Street or Court Street or Chapel Street in New Haven,
yeah,
and you're, you know, chasing somebody 80, 100 miles an hour, I mean, it's not safe for the officer. It's not safe for the driver, whether he, no matter what he or she's done. And then the public too. So it's definitely a controversial subject in that sense, for sure.
Yeah, no, I think for sure. We've actually had on the show State Representative Greg Howard, who's a Republican, who's very, very aggressive on criminal justice, you know, sort of more in the very police should be more aggressive category. He is a police officer himself. And even he says, he goes, look, if you're, he uses the exact example you just used. If you're in downtown New Haven, you're probably not interested in getting into a high-speed car chase. But, you know, there might be a sort of a middle ground. It's going to sound like a stupid question, Jeff Derderian, but is it easy to take this thing off the back of a car? Like, if I'm a perp and I'm getting this thing shot in the back of my car, can't I just get out and unstick it and throw it at the side of the road? What's the?
I mean, I think you could do that, and that's, you know, probably one of the things that police considered when they got it. But you've got to know that it's there, so they can strategically put it in a place that. And it doesn't, you know, it's not like a brick hitting the back of your car. It's a, you know, and think about it. If you're in a high speed chase and there's traffic and sirens and all this other stuff, you won't even hear the thing hit your car. So you've got to know that it's there. Now, granted, could you then look outside or look under the bumper and try and find it? Sure, you could. I mean, you can be Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible and search under the car and undo all that stuff. But I think the likelihood of it is fairly low because the way that they can strategically place it. But, you know, not every system is perfect. So, and this is certainly not a perfect system. And, you know, I'm sure there's other flaws with it that, that police are aware of when they use this as an investigative tool. But I think it's, you know, I think the argument is like, look, this is much better than, you know, there being some fatal, horrific accident or someone going up on a curb, God forbid, and, you know, mowing people down in New Haven. This allows them to, you know, sort of catch up. They can, the way the chief put it was, is that we'll find you and we'll decide when we're going to find you. So it could be 10 minutes later, it could be 2 hours later. So I think that's the other element that they like, that they're able to have, you know, things like this are always about control, right? Who's in control. So I think they like that. They like being able to sort of, you know, they can strategically, you know, map out a perimeter. They said they can get backup in case they need it. So there's a whole bunch of benefits that do, I think, come with it. And other departments, really quick, in Connecticut are starting to use it. New Haven was one of the first to get it, but there are other departments that are starting to bring it online. So I think you're going to probably start to hear and see more about it.
Right. Jeff Derderian, investigative reporter at News 8. Jeff, talking about the intersections of our two beats, investigative and politics, you did an interesting story about another kind of in the vein of police and traffic enforcement. They're called yellow envelopes. Tell us what the yellow envelope initiative or program or push is.
Yeah, so in Connecticut now, we have the blue envelope system and the green envelope system for people that you know, have some sort of disability or challenge, perhaps, in that when they're pulled over by a police officer, maybe they're not the driver, but they're the passenger. And so right now, the blue envelope, if someone is in the car that has autism or maybe a driver who has autism or is on the spectrum, they can hand this blue envelope to an officer and it has all of their paperwork, all of their information inside. It explains to the officer that either the driver or the person has autism. And so be a little patient. You know, maybe, you know, the one example that someone gave to me really, really fast here is that, you know, if an officer says, you know, crack your window, that, you know, someone perhaps with autism will just crack it like very, very, very little. And because they'll just follow the direction, and the officer might get upset because they didn't open it enough and start to, you know, maybe exchange words with the person. But to answer your question, Mike, the yellow envelope, the legislation that's now being proposed, that would be for people with cognitive challenges. For example, you know, maybe a cerebral palsy or ADHD or any some other type of challenge like that. So it would basically inform the police officer that there's someone with a cognitive or an intellectual challenge or disability that's either in the car as a passenger or driving. And so I think it's, you know, it's going to take some training, and officers will need to kind of get up to speed on it. But the people who are advocating for it are really excited about it because they think it's just another step of informing the officer, keeping the public, you know, feeling a little bit better if they get pulled over. Because if someone is someone who is autistic or maybe has cerebral palsy or some other challenge, they could really be, you know, sort of nervous and think about it. You know, there's lights, there's sirens, it's triggering in some effect for someone with autism. The folks were telling me when I did the story this week. So I think it's going to really go a long way for people with these, you know, with the challenges that that we just know about, and allows them to sort of have a level of comfort. And it also helps the officer, because the officer, like one of the chief told me that, you know, in Watertown, that look, the officer goes up to the car, he doesn't know what he's facing necessarily,
right?
He doesn't know if you're a gangbanger, a thug, a murderer, a mom, a dad. He has no idea. So it's good on both sides. In other words, they slip this brightly colored envelope through the window, and it kind of disarms the situation, if you will, for both. So we'll see what happens. I guess you know more about this than me. It has to go through committee first, and I would be surprised if it doesn't pass, but because since we already have the blue and the green, and the green is for people who don't know, green is for visually impaired. So we would have the green, the yellow, and the blue.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, typically if it doesn't require a lot of money, then it has a better chance of passing. But, Jeff, I want to get and we're chatting with Jeff Derderian, investigative reporter. Jeff, you've been doing reporting on breaking news and investigations for a very, very long time. I know you haven't necessarily covered it firsthand, but I just want to get your thoughts as an investigative reporter. What type of questions should we be asking about this situation in Waterbury with the stepmom who held her son captive, allegedly, for 2 decades. I mean, again, I know you haven't done any firsthand reporting on this yet, but what type of questions, as an investigative reporter, would you be looking at in this situation? What type of questions should maybe we in the public be focused on?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Mike, some of the questions have already been asked by a lot of good journalists in Connecticut and certainly at WTNH. But I think for me, it's, you know, where was the well-being checks? Where did that sort of fall off? And the school's role and what sort of happened there? How did the dots get missed, or where were the missed opportunities to find out, you know, that this person was inside this house for so long? So I think you have to kind of go back, you have to peel back the layers of the onion and see, you know, who are the people that had touch points at that house, and look at, you know, what's the history, and who was aware of his well-being or non-well-being, and where was he? Was he not in school? In other words, what happened? And so where were the cracks? And I'm sure we're going to find out. But I think for me, that's probably some of the first place I would go. It's just, so where's the accountability? How do you, because you start at the beginning and then you work your way back, right, with stories like this, in my opinion. So you start, we know what happened. Okay, we know the current, but let's go back and find out what were the things leading up to that might have gotten missed. And it's not necessarily a blame game. It's just it's really, and it's going to sound Pollyanna, but what way should the system be improved for the future so this never happens again? I mean, this young person, you know, is just horrific conditions, according to police. So I think for me, that's where I would have started. I just was on other stories this week, and it just last week it just kind of how it goes, Mike. You know how it
is.
Yeah,
of course.
I think there's going to be, you know, there'll be some more significant reporting that comes out of this story, as it should be, because, you know, people do want information and they want answers on how did this happen? How does it, like, in other words, it's 2025, and how does someone who is that age, you know, basically is kept captive, you know, like the chief said, the chief of police said, worse than a prison cell. And, you know, he's 68 or 70 pounds or whatever he was when he came out. He's, I don't, you know, can't remember exactly, but he's 6 feet or he's not, you know, it's just, it's mind boggling. And it's an international and a national story now. So it's not just Connecticut. So I think you'll have, also have people like the New York Times looking into it and the Washington Post and things, you know, sort of places where, you know, they don't need to turn a story in that day or the next day, but they'll work on it. And, you know, and in Connecticut, there's great journalists in Connecticut who will do this, who will find out. And, you know, WTNH will be one of them, I'm sure.
For sure. Jeff, finally here, have you ever heard of anything like this? I mean, like I said, you're so experienced. You've done this in a few different places here in the Northeast. You've investigated things. Have you ever seen anything like this? Have you ever heard of anything like this? I mean, it does seem
Not like this exactly for this period of time. I have heard of, you know, and have, you know, covered situations where people were held captive, you know, against their will for some period of time. And, you know, these people were really good at hiding it and keeping them inside. And the other thing too, Mike, which I just don't know, is, you know, how do the neighbors, you know, everybody's worried about what happens in their own house, right? Like you walk by your neighbor's house and you think everything's fine, right? They wave, you wave at them. Oh, hey, how's it going? Oh, hey, yeah, it's going to be warm today. Oh, great. Have a good day. But it just goes to show that you never know what the heck is going on in someone's house, right? Where you live. So, but for me, yeah, I have covered different stories like this before in the past, but this one I got to tell you is really the whole set of circumstances and, you know, how he got attention so he could, you know, be freed and just get out of there. Like it's a unique set of facts and circumstances. There's no doubt about it. But these stories do come up. And unfortunately, these people who, you know, and this woman is obviously innocent until proven guilty. These are just allegations. But in general, okay, these stories, you know, these people that have been involved in these types of stories that I've covered in the past, they're just really good at covering their tracks, and they're really good about being quiet, and they don't make a ruckus, and they just, you know, they don't draw a lot of attention to themselves. Mm. So that's how people are able to kind of secretly, you know, hold these people against their will, because they're not the noisiest neighbor. They don't have parties. Police aren't necessarily called to the house all the time. So they're very skilled at keeping their life quiet. In other words, what, you know, they're saying, keeping their life off the front page, because that's how they're just able to blend in. And it's just, you know, it's kind of frightening when you think about it, but those people do exist. And we'll see what happens in this case. The legal course will now move forward, and her attorney, you know, claims she's innocent. Not what you think. Don't judge a book by a cover, basically, is what he's saying. I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say that, but that's in essence what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. We'll see how it unfolds for sure.
Yeah. Investigative reporter Jeff Derderian, WTNH.com, YouTube, Jeff Derderian, Dart Technology, Yellow Envelopes, a lot of great stories about what's impacting Connecticut. And tomorrow, I believe it's 1:30 in the afternoon tomorrow, if you go to New Haven in the afternoon tomorrow, you'll see the parade and you'll see News 8, us in our big red jackets, and Jeff will be there marching along with everybody. So say hi, and Jeff, I'll see you tomorrow.
Great, thanks, Mike. Really quick, if people just find me on social for story ideas so I can stay ahead of Mike Cerulli, I gotta work harder now, like I said last week, since you're around.
Yeah.
So Jeff Derderian TV on Instagram, and then just search me on Facebook, Jeff Derderian, Derderian. So Instagram, Facebook, send me story ideas. Send them to me before you send them to Cerulli. That's all I ask, all right?
I can't endorse that, but there's Jeff Derderian's socials and his contact information. Send him all your tips.
Great.
Jeff, thanks for being here, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks, Mike. Hi, man. See you tomorrow. Bye.
Yeah, Jeff, a true asset, I think, to the News 8 team. Able to, as he was saying, take a few days, work on a story, really dig into stuff. And, you know, you lose a lot of that. Not lost on me, and if those who listen to the Mike Cerulli Show regularly will know that this is one of the things I harp on quite a bit. Really not lost on me. We have this national and, as Jeff said, even international story out of Waterbury, Connecticut, where there's an alleged, very heinous alleged crime, and then the implication being, or the suggestion, or the potentially next steps being to, hey, let's look at the local authorities, let's look at the state authorities, let's see if anybody dropped the ball here, let's see if there's systemic failures that led to what allegedly happened to this young man happening to him. And normally, if this was 20 years ago, if this was 30 years ago, if this was even 10 or 15 years ago, you would have had leading the way. You would have had police reporters. You would have had City Hall, multiple City Hall reporters, investigative reporters, columnists at the Waterbury Republican-American. This was one of the great newspapers. And I'm not to say it's not still a great, it's a great resource and outlet for people to use if you live in that area. They have some great reporters. I work alongside Paul Hughes, who I think is one of the best in the business here in Connecticut. But without a doubt, 30 years ago, the Waterbury Republican-American would have had the additional resources, and frankly, all of us would have had the research. News 8, the Waterbury Republican-American, the Hartford Current, all of us would have had all the other TV stations, WFSB, NBC Connecticut, would have all had more resources to dedicate to digging into what exactly happened, to get answers for all of you on what happened here. And unfortunately, as we've talked about, and again, it's sort of my soapbox, but we live in a time now where the Waterbury Republican-American has just been bought by a large newspaper conglomerate. They are behind a paywall, and I understand that's what they have to do to stay viable, but they're behind a paywall, meaning their services reach less, the reporting reaches fewer people. The print circulation has obviously gone down, as it has for all newspapers. Those of us in the television business, we do have great investigative reporters like Jeff Derderian, but frankly, fewer resources, reporting resources to commit to long lead stories. And I think it would be foolish to suggest that that will not have an impact on the speed and the quality of the investigations into this. So I don't know what to do about any of that. other than, as someone who does it, maybe I work a little bit harder. That's kind of my own personal answer to it. But it is something to think about as you make your own personal decisions. Maybe you consider subscribing to the Waterbury Republican-American. Maybe you consider donating to a nonprofit newsroom like the Connecticut Mirror. Those are little things people can do so that when stuff like this happens, the Connecticut Mirror has a human services reporter and a children's reporter, and the Waterbury Republican-American has an investigative reporter able to dedicate and find answers on the stories that matter to people. So that's the soapbox moment. We're going to dive more into the energy issue in the next hour with someone who's been out front on it here in Connecticut, and the President of the United States weighing in on Connecticut energy bills. That's how far this situation has gotten. We'll dive into it here. Stay with us.
Join the conversation to talk about whatever's on your mind. 203-333-9422. The Mike Cerulli Show is back on WICC.
It's a pipeline going through a small section of New York. New York's held it up for years, actually, for years. They've wanted to do it for years and years. And it will reduce the most expensive energy almost in the world is in New England, because they have no way of getting it there because it's been held up by New York. And the whole of New England and Connecticut and New York, the energy prices are through the roof. And this one pipeline will save for per family $2,500 just on heating, and another $2,500 on everything else. So the energy, by just a simple pipeline going through an area that wants it, an area that's not a rich area, it's actually a very poor area, would create jobs and everything else. And it's going to be way underground. Nobody's going to see it. Once they fill it up, nobody's going to see it. Nobody's going to know it's there. And families in New York and Connecticut and New England are going to save $5,000 a family. Think of that. Because right now they have the highest energy prices maybe in the world, they say. New England is a disaster. So we're working on that. In fact, the governor's coming in, governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, who's a very nice woman. She's coming in tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock to meet me on that and other things. Not only that, but other things. So I hope we don't have to use the extraordinary powers of the federal government to get it done. But if we have to, we will. But I don't think we'll have to.
That obviously is the voice of the President of the United States talking about, of all things, the cost of energy and heating here in the state of Connecticut, saying it's, you know, kind of wild and the highest in the world. And he's mentioning something that has been bubbling under the surface for some time now. And I want to take some credit here. I've reported on this a bit, obviously reported a lot on the debates over expanding energy supply here in Connecticut, but have specifically was one of the, I think, the first person that the governor, Governor Lamont, talked to on the record following his meeting with Energy Secretary Chris Wright and Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, obviously two of President Trump's top officials on this. And the reason that we're talking about pipelines, and it sort of, it gets a little bit in the weeds here. But one of the issues that Connecticut has is a supply issue. You hear that from all these politicians, Lamont and all of them say there's a supply issue, there's a supply issue, there's a supply issue. We don't have enough energy supply, and it's particularly pronounced in the wintertime when they say supply, they're talking predominantly about supply for electricity generation. So I think everyone's familiar with the concept of natural gas. You light it on fire, it can ultimately turns a turbine that creates electricity or whatever happens inside those power plants. You understand that, right? Natural gas creates electricity. Nuclear power creates electricity. Wind and solar creates electricity. The other thing natural gas does is, many people will be familiar with this, is it heats homes, right? And in the wintertime when it gets cold out, Connecticut's in the odd situation where you then have sort of two competing demands for natural gas. You have electricity generation and you have heating. And when that capacity goes up, when the demand goes up, they often, the state, not the government, but just sort of the energy market as an entity, turns to European and elsewhere liquefied natural gas, which is natural gas that they take and they freeze, basically, because, of course, a gas, if you cool it down enough, becomes a liquid. And they put it in these ships, these very odd-looking ships called LNG, liquefied natural gas tankers. They Google a picture of an LNG tanker. They look very strange. They stick them on a ship. They sail them across a huge body of water. They bring them to somewhere in the northeastern United States. And sometimes, all the time, actually, they have to take the liquefied natural gas. They have to bring it back up to a gaseous state and then typically shoot it out on a pipeline or put it into some sort of, storage facility to then be used by either heating of the homes or electricity generation. And that's incredibly expensive. As you might imagine, that process I just described of you take natural gas from like Norway or somewhere, and then you cool it down so that it becomes liquid. You stick it on a ship, you sail it across the Atlantic Ocean, and then you reheat it up to a gas, and then you shoot it out to wherever it needs to go. It's expensive. And there's a whole debate. We've had State Representative Chris Rosario, Democrat of Bridgeport, on the show to discuss the whole debate about the ships, and there's these old United States laws that sort of bar the idea that a ship could easily go from Texas up to Connecticut. That's a whole other discussion. But one of the solutions people have pointed to is, well, hang on a minute. There's a huge deposit of natural gas underneath Pennsylvania and parts of New York. It's called the Marcellus Formation. It's hundreds of millions of years old, buried beneath shale rock in Pennsylvania. And it's a huge natural gas reserve. Some think it might be one of the largest natural gas deposits in the world. And in the last couple of decades, some very smart engineers figured out that if you take like a drill bit and fire usually water through it and at a very high rate and puncture that shale rock, you can release the natural gas. That's in very, very layman's terms, and I'm sure I'm getting the exact details wrong, but that's essentially what fracking is, right? And so there's been this fracking boom in Pennsylvania. We've seen how that's played out for the state. It's created lots and lots of jobs. It's impacted the politics of the state. And it's created abundant natural gas. The problem is Connecticut has a hard time. Connecticut, just a couple states over, one or two states over from Pennsylvania, can't access any of it. Can't access as much of it as some people would like us to access. For a lot of reasons, one of them being the one that the president just outlined, which is New York State. And, I'm not trashing the validity of this argument, but New York State, Connecticut, and others, the people who run those states are very concerned about man-made climate change, about the scientifically proven notion that if you release carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at a high rate, you warm the planet. And that at a certain point, there are a lot of negative effects to warming the planet, particularly warming the planet beyond its natural processes, meaning artificially warming the planet. There's obviously negative impacts of that. And because of the climate movement and other factors, but mostly because of the climate movement over decades, there is a resistance among states led by Democrats who draw some of their political power from the climate movement to building new natural gas infrastructure, to expanding additional natural gas infrastructure. And I'm going to inject something into this, which is not only is there a
opposition to natural gas emanating from the left in the form of the climate movement, which I think we're all familiar with. I sort of just described it in a very circuitous way, but people understand, right? The climate activists, generally speaking, do not want new fossil fuel infrastructure or expanded fossil fuel infrastructure. Here in Connecticut, I think most people who observe Connecticut politics would probably say the climate lobby, the environmental lobby, exists, but it's not some force to be reckoned with politically. What is a force to be reckoned with here in Connecticut? Have you ever heard of the NIMBY movement, N-I-M-B-Y, the not in my backyard? You typically hear the NIMBY movement described in relationship to building of housing. It's a huge debate in the legislature every year about state housing laws. And, you know, NIMBY is sort of used as a pejorative to describe people who live typically in suburbs, upper middle class suburbs, upper class suburbs, who oppose new housing developments. And so that's where we typically hear that term in the context of. But there's also a NIMBY movement when it relates to energy infrastructure. And it's sort of an odd combination of left-wing environmentalists and then the sort of general NIMBY crowd that says, I don't want you building a natural gas pipeline in my backyard. And, of course, the NIMBY attitude, and we could debate about this for hours, but the NIMBY attitude is somewhat correlated to a conservative attitude. Hey, you know, not in my backyard, not get off my lawn, right? Now, you could also argue that the NIMBY attitude is antithetical to conservatism, to free markets, because why would the government be able to limit through zoning laws what you can build? There's a libertarian argument against NIMBYism. But in any event, there is a collision here in Connecticut, or really a combination here in Connecticut, of environmentalists who don't want to see new natural gas infrastructure and people who live in communities where they may be proposing new natural gas infrastructure where they're opposed to it just because they don't want stuff being built in their backyard. And look, let's just be honest about it, right? We can all, as sort of high-minded radio show hosts and journalists, say, well, you know, with today's technology, natural gas infrastructure is very, very safe. And nuclear technology is very, very safe. And the Boeing 737 MAX is very, very safe if you actually dive into the statistics of it. That's a true statement, right? Those three things are true, right? We have huge advances in natural gas infrastructure, very safe engineers, very smart. Nuclear infrastructure, very safe, very smart. The safest, actually, way of producing energy compared to coal and other things that kill thousands and thousands of people every year through deleterious health effects. And then you could say, you know, the Boeing 737 MAX, actually, compared to the car you drive to work in, is like orders of magnitude safer. And that you can say that, and it's academic, you can say that. But then you ask a second question. Okay, can we build it in your backyard? Can we build the pipeline infrastructure near your kid's middle school? Can we build that new nuclear power plant downriver, upriver from where you get your drinking water? Do you want to take your next family vacation on a Boeing 737 MAX? It's a classic collision between logical thinking and emotional thinking. And in politics, those two things often are at odds with each other, right? You could have all the experts in the world tell you, look, nuclear energy is incredibly safe. It's carbon-free. There hasn't been a major nuclear incident in the United States in years. The ones we have had haven't killed anybody for the most part. And again, compared to coal, when you think about it, thousands and thousands of people get killed by coal because of the health effects and the pollution. And I'm not just talking about global warming. I'm talking about coal in the water, coal in the lungs, kills a lot of people, way more people than Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, all that stuff put together has killed. But again, the personal question being, all right, let's build it upriver from you. Let's put that compressor station for that natural gas pipeline in the back of your kid's middle school. Well, you're going to Disney World next week, you're getting on a Boeing 737 MAX. At that point, the logical thinking starts to break down. It becomes emotional reasoning. And in the state of Connecticut, we have that issue here, right, where there are proposals on the table to expand natural gas infrastructure in the backyards of Connecticut suburbs. And so as we talk about, as much as the anger over electricity rates has reached a fever pitch here, as much as the federal government under President Trump seems to want to expand natural gas infrastructure, the next conversation will inevitably be, okay, in whose backyard are we going to do that? In whose backyard are we going to do that? And
to bring it back to the conversation we had with our friend Brandon McGee early in the show, historically, and I don't want to, you know, people might dial in and say, oh, Cerulli, you're being too woke here, but historically, and, you know, you call it woke, but I would urge anybody to dial 203-333-9422 and challenge me on the history here. Historically, when there's debates like that about environmentalism and pollution and where do we put this infrastructure, historically, the thing they've done is they've put it in inner cities. That's just a fact. And if you don't, if you think that that sounds woke or whatever, go drive around Bridgeport. Go drive around Hartford, New Haven. Where are all the smokestacks? They're not in Trumbull and Darien. And there's a reason for that, because of the politics of this. Right? So now we're entering a situation where environmentalism, NIMBYism, are going to be stacked up against people's frustration about the skyrocketing cost of electricity here in Connecticut. And then stack on top of that the fact that these Democratic governors, for the most part, and I would say Ned Lamont might be an exclusion to this, do not want to be seen as holding hands with President Trump and Doug Burgum and Chris Wright. So you're having this collision of all these different political factors, the hate, Democratic dislike of Trump, NIMBYism, environmentalism, anger over electric rates, in some cases very personal circumstances from these some of these politicians that make them not want to have pipelines built here or there, and we'll, you know, we could talk about that more in the future. But the point being is it's a fraught situation. But I have looked at this a lot of different ways. I've talked to a lot of people. And one of the things everyone agrees on, including Governor Ned Lamont, is one of the fastest ways to help lower the cost of household cost of energy is to expand natural gas capacity. So I say all this, I go into the history of all that just to say, you're going to see this debate play out here in Connecticut. You're going to see this debate. We are morphing from anger over electric rates, anger towards the government, to now, hang on a minute, there is a confluence of factors that might actually be presenting us with a solution. And it's on the table, or will soon be on the table, to expand natural gas infrastructure. And that is going to be a debate you're going to see. And do I think it's going to be the same type of debate as we saw over highway tolls or over electric vehicle mandates or over raising the sales tax or introducing an income tax? Like, probably not. But it's going to be a similar style of debate where you have all of these different interests colliding with each other. And I think, just as a journalist, it's going to be fascinating to watch that. And as a resident, I think it's going to be interesting to see how these interests shake out. Does the NIMBY impulse to not have a pipeline running through your backyard trump the idea, pun intended, I guess, that people want to see cheaper costs to heat their home in the winter? Cheaper cost to turn the air conditioning on in the summer? Do the ghosts of what they call, and again, you could say woke all you want, but what they call environmental racism, where again, where are those smokestacks built? Where is the water quality the worst? Where has there been underinvestment in infrastructure? Just go drive down 95 or up 95. Where are the smokestacks? You know? Do the ghosts of those impulses come back and haunt us today as we look to expand infrastructure? All those questions are going to come to the forefront, I think, in the next few months, if not weeks. Meaning Trump met this past week with Governor Kathy Hochul, who's integral to all this. Governor Ned Lamont had meetings with the Energy Secretary and the Interior Secretary, who have been given cognizance over this issue. It's obviously on the president's mind. He's talking about it. I think that was in like a press gaggle with the Secretary General of NATO or something. So he's talking about it. And the one thing we know about this president is when he gets an idea in his head, and I'm not trying to be like, you know, dismissive of it. When he gets an idea in his head, let's buy Greenland, you know, let's buy the Panama, let's get the Panama Canal back. It kind of seems like they're trying to do those things, right? And I think this might be one of the things he focuses in on. Remember, this is a guy from this area, right? He used to have a house in Greenwich. He obviously is a New Yorker kind of through and through, more than he's anything else. He's a New Yorker. So prepare yourself to hear this debate, natural gas, and to get into the specifics of this, because I've been kind of giving a broad strokes overview, to get into some of the specifics of what we're talking about. We're going to have the sort of energy leader and the Republican side here in Connecticut, and arguably the energy leader just generally in the legislature. State Senator Ryan Fazio is going to be joining us with some specifics on these proposals in just a few minutes here on the Mike Cerulli Show. So bottom of the hour news, going to get some updates for you on some top local and national headlines. and then we're going to talk with Ryan Fazio about one of the foremost proposals that could lower your energy costs here in Connecticut in the near term. Stay with us here.
Live and local news and talk for Milford, it's the Mike Cerulli Show on WICC. Join the conversation, 203-333-9422.
It's a pipeline going through a small section of New York. New York's held it up for years, actually, for years. They've wanted to do it for years and years. And it will reduce the most expensive energy almost in the world is in New England, because they have no way of getting it there because it's been held up by New York. And the whole of New England and Connecticut and New York, the energy prices are through the roof. And this one pipeline will save for per family $2,500 just on heating and another $2,500 on everything else. So the energy by just a simple pipeline going through an area that wants it, an area that's not a rich area. It's actually a very poor area. We create jobs and everything else. And it's going to be way underground. Nobody's going to see it. Once they fill it up, nobody's going to see it. Nobody's going to know it's there. And families in New York and Connecticut and New England are going to save $5,000 a family. Think of that. Because right now they have the highest energy prices maybe in the world, they say. New England is a disaster. So.
That, of course, is President Donald Trump talking about something our next guest has discussed quite frequently, which is the high cost of energy here in the United States. So joining us now is State Senator Ryan Fazio. Senator Fazio, welcome back to the Mike Cerulli Show.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So what's the president getting right? What's he getting wrong there? And what is he talking about, this pipeline situation? You and I have had discussions about this, but for many people, this might be the first time they're becoming aware of it.
Well, put it this way. New England gets a plurality of its energy on the electric grid from natural gas plants, about 40 or 45%. Nuclear is the next most prevalent source of electricity in New England. And it's also, natural gas is also the lowest cost source of energy generation and power generation in New England. The problem is that there is a limit to how much natural gas we can get to New England, and the bottleneck is in the natural gas pipeline capacity. In the winter, we have obviously a higher degree of demand for natural gas, and when the pipeline reaches capacity, the heating system, the natural gas heating system, gets preference over the electric generation system. So those power plants can't generate as much natural gas power from natural gas as they want, and our power prices go way up in the winter. And you know, in the future, it's going to be a problem because we're not going to be able to generate enough electricity. Now, a solution would obviously be, which is very capital intensive, it's a major political project as well, to expand the capacity on the natural gas pipeline from New York, to the Algonquin and Iroquois pipeline, both go through New York, in order to get us cheaper, more plentiful natural gas, which comes out of Pennsylvania, the Marcellus Shale, where it's very cheap. There's been proposals over the years to expand the natural gas pipeline capacity from the west. It's normally been shot down either by New York's administration or Massachusetts, and hasn't necessarily been supported by, the Democratic leadership in Connecticut over the years either. Obviously, there was the Killingly natural gas plant that was proposed in 2019, which the Lamont administration opposed. Well, fast forward to 2025, it looks like we have more and more support on a bipartisan basis for expanding natural gas capacity from the west. You've had Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, Ned Lamont, Norm Needleman, state senator, all speak positively about potentially expanding natural gas capacity to the west. I've been saying for years that mathematically we need it. It's an economic necessity. It's not a nice to have for 10 years down the line. Other Republicans have been saying the same. So maybe we have bipartisan agreement finally on this topic, and hopefully we can get something done to lower energy prices and ensure we have security, energy security in the future as well.
So I hear what you're saying, State Senator Fazio. And I want to know, like, what would it look like in Connecticut? Would we have to? Because it sounds like some of this stuff, the gas actually wouldn't be coming to Connecticut, right? It would be going to other northeastern states. But as a region, it would increase the supply, which would, you know, this is basic economics. You increase supply, hopefully you lower a little bit of the prices, right? What would it look like in Connecticut? Like, in terms of, would there be construction in Connecticut? Would there be more gas coming into Connecticut through Connecticut? What does it look like for the average Connecticut resident, obviously aside from the fact that one day it might lead to their bill being smaller?
You know, to take your question literally, it doesn't look like much, because all you really need to do is expand the diameter of the existing pipeline, which is, you know, a very important, but, you know, physically not a very overwhelming construction project. They would dig up the pipeline as it comes in. It goes through New York, through Connecticut, and expand it from, you know, X amount of inches to X inches plus, you know, plus 5 or 6 inches in diameter. It's a discrete project, you know, that almost no one would ever see. But it could have enormous economic benefits to the region. It could lower natural gas prices substantially, lower electric bills and natural gas bills in the future substantially, even while paying for the capital investment that it would take. But there's two pipelines that go from New York through Connecticut, the Iroquois and the Algonquin pipeline. And I think the